is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, I've narrated a book, a children's book. I'll tell you about that a little later on in the program. The Iran deal, I think that the reason, one of the reasons that some of the wiser, elder Republicans are freaking out about this is that if Tehran normalizes relations with the United States and thus with, well, actually with the entire West, the entire Western world. I mean, keep in mind, this was a deal that was worked out with England, with Germany, with Russia, with China, and the United States. If Iran normalizes their relationship with these countries, and if it is true what President Bonnie Sauter said back 2 years ago in the Christian Science Monitor, that he was elected president of Iran in 1980, in the summer of 1980, while Reagan was campaigning against Carter and while the hostages were being held in Iran, on a platform of freeing the hostages, he took 76% of the vote. He said 97% of the vote went to free the hostages candidates. Only 3% of the vote went to keep the hostages candidates. So he gets elected. It's the summer of 1980. And he goes to the Ayatollah and says, okay, let's free the hostages. And the Ayatollah says, no, we've got to deal with the Reagan campaign to keep the hostages. And sure enough, they did, right up until literally the minute that Ronald Reagan raised his hand, put his hand on the Bible, and raised his hand to take the oath of office. That was the moment that the plane left the ground in Iran with the hostages on it. No coincidence. That was Iran's way of saying, we kept our end of the deal. Now, where's those weapons? Where are those spare parts that you promised us? And of course, Reagan supplied them. That was the Iran-Contra deal. So I think that some of the Republicans who maybe were involved with that, like Bush Sr., or knew about that, you know, the old guard of the Republican Party, they're pretty freaked out about this. Because, you know, there's got to be records of that in Tehran. And if those records get out, look out. It might bring down St. Ronnie. You mean St. Ronnie committed treason? We know Nixon did. You've all heard that clip played dozens of times on this show. So, anyway, there's that. Scott Walker introduced himself to the country day before yesterday with his announcement speech, and I have 22 clips from his speech that I want to share with you over the course of the next 2.5 hours, or 2.75 hours. Along with my commentary, because I think, A, this guy is going to be the Republican nominee for president, or at worst, vice president. But I think he's going to be the nominee for president, because the Koch brothers are behind him, and they now own the Republican Party, or a good chunk of it. And you've got a Koch brothers operative who is now running Donald Trump's campaign, and Donald Trump is running around trashing Jeb Bush. He's not trashing Scott Walker. He's trashing Jeb Bush. And I think, you know, Donald Trump's a billionaire. The Koch brothers are billionaires. I think the billionaires got together and said, you know, we don't want Bush. And leading the charge against Bush, Donald Trump. And then once Bush is knocked out, you know, once Bush or Jeb, he doesn't like using Bush. Once Jeb Bush is knocked out of the race, then Scott Walker becomes the presumptive nominee and, you know, off to the White House. With Marco Rubio as his running mate, or Brian Sandoval, or somebody like that. So anyhow, this is the first clip. We'll just take them in chronological order. Scott Walker working at McDonald's.
Now, as a kid, my first job was washing dishes at the Countryside Restaurant. Then I moved up to the big time. I started flipping hamburgers in high school at McDonald's to save up for college.
Right, to save up for college. See, back in those days, for him, that would have been the 1980s. For me, that was the 1960s. But, you know, pretty much the same. Reaganism had not yet sunk into America. And you could actually pay for your college tuition by working, you know, a summer job. I did. You know, my mother did. My father got the GI Bill. You know, most of my friends did. I mean, tuition was cheap at community colleges and state universities. I mean, I didn't go to Harvard, but so I find it a little ironic that Scott Walker, who has in the budget that he just signed last week in Wisconsin, cut $250 million out of funding for the University of Wisconsin. Scott Walker, who opposes unions, which provide good pay, Scott Walker, who thinks we should have no minimum wage, is bragging about the fact that he was alive during a time in America when New Deal economics were being practiced and you could actually work a summer job and put yourself through college. I mean, does he miss the irony of that? That those days are long gone? You have to have two people working full-time year-long to pay for college now. It's nuts. Here's clip number two about his mom and dad's jobs.
My dad, who you heard before, was a small-town preacher, and my mom was a part-time secretary and bookkeeper.
Right, and back then, you know, part-time secretary, bookkeeper, small-town preacher, you could live in this country and have a middle-class lifestyle. The Social Security, in inflation-adjusted terms, was paying more than it is now for retired people. Wages were higher right across the board. Back then, the largest employer in the United States, which kind of set the floor for wages, was General Motors. And they were paying what in today's inflation-adjusted dollars would be somewhere between $45 and $55 an hour in today's money. You could raise a family on that. My dad did. He worked in a tool and die shop. But Walker isn't talking about, you know, since Reaganism, you know, his mom and dad probably would have had a much radically scaled back lifestyle. You know, American, I think the average credit card debt now in the United States is I recall several numbers. One was $13,000 and the other was $27,000, but it's substantial. I mean, Americans are in debt just to maintain their lifestyle. Not to mention, you know, $1.4 trillion in student debt. So here's Scott Walker bragging about how the economy worked so well when we were using FDR's economic model before Reagan had completely changed everything. In fact, clip number three, this is about his grandfather.
My dad's dad was a machinist for 42 years at Barber Coleman down in Rockford, Illinois.
Right. And my dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years in Lansing, Michigan. And he made enough money to buy a house and pay it off and buy a new car every 3 years, sometimes every 2 years, take us on vacation for a couple of weeks every year, help some of my brothers with the cost of going to school and getting apprenticeships and whatnot. I mean, and mom didn't work. You could do that back then. This was pre-Reagan. But Scott Walker's policies will not make it possible to go back to that era that he is bragging about. They will make it impossible. As president, he wants to double down on Reaganomics, as I will be sharing with you as we continue through the program today. I mean, just absolutely double down on Reaganomics. So, anyhow, stick around. We'll be back. We'll also be taking your calls throughout the day. It's anything goes summer. You can talk about Scott Walker or anything else you want. You see this story in the Daily Mail about how global warming is delaying flights? Planes are in the air longer because the jet stream's all screwed up because of global warming? And they had this wild storm in Norway? We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, the destruction of our planet is full tilt boogie. And now it turns out ExxonMobil, even after in 2007 they said they'd stop funding climate deniers, they're still doing it. Welcome back. Michael, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, how are you?
Hey, Mr. Harvard. Okay, anything goes summer. Yeah. 25 seconds. Just wondering your thoughts on how after World War II ended in 1945 with the dropping of two atomic bombs and the death of roughly 70 million people worldwide dead, and only 5 years later, humans were at war again with Korea. What does that say about the human male, and will we ever learn? Thank you, Tom.
Well, that's a good question. Michael, I think, the human male, yeah. I don't really know. I don't know that much about the history of the Korean conflict or Harry, you know, how Harry Truman got us into it. And I do know that, you know, Harry Truman got us into it. It was a very unpopular war. It was a horrible war. One of my wife's uncle fought in that war, and he came back home and he threw his medals away and he said, don't ever talk to me about it. And he refused for the rest of his life. He just died last year, refused for the rest of his life to even discuss it. He was so wounded by that. The Koreans, I know, you know, some of the stories that I've read about this, the North Koreans had, they would send women toward the U.S. soldiers with their hands in the air, but their elbows down, and they had hand grenades underneath their armpits. And when they got close to the soldiers, they'd lift their arms up, and the hand grenades would go off, and it would kill the soldiers. And so the American soldiers started just massacring civilians when they tried to surrender, because they never knew, were they booby trapped or not. And it was just a god awful war. But Michael, do you know any more about it?
No, but god awful is a great term, because here we are, a Christian nation, and it says in the Bible, whatever, that thou shalt not murder.
That's
the occupation of generals, right? I mean, that's the occupation of war.
Well, arguably, the occupation of generals is defense, but in an offensive war, certainly that is murder. And I would say, you know, what George W. Bush did in Iraq was murder, both to the Iraqis and to our soldiers, and arguably Afghanistan as well.
I know you got calls. Thank you, Tom.
Okay, good talking to you, Benjamin in Madison, Mississippi. Hey, Benjamin, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Tom, I was just wondering if maybe you could help me understand some things, because I've come around a couple points that you've made in the past, but I really have this trouble wrapping my head around what makes news in the media. It seems like certain networks, you know, make a living off things that, you know, are really not that, I guess some people would say they were important, but, you know, you know, the week they had the infamous pool party and an unruly teen got thrown to the ground, we had three minorities here in Jackson murder a white guy in the parking lot. And, of course, there was no coverage of that, you know. And, you know, this week there was in Cincinnati.
You think there should be? You think that should have been a national story? Why?
Well, I don't think a teen being thrown to the ground is a national story that didn't, you know, obey an officer.
I think that when there's a consequential, apparently consequential racial undertone to it, it is a national story, Benjamin. Thanks for the call. We'll be right back. So back to Scott Walker. I find it fascinating how Scott Walker is promoting Reaganism, and in fact you're going to hear this quite vividly in just a few moments, and yet is bragging about having grown up in Franklin Delano Roosevelt's world, basically. Here he is talking about working hard and playing by the rules, clip number four.
My brother and I have thought back throughout the years, and we've realized we did inherit fame or fortune from our family. What we got was the belief that if you work hard and you play by the rules, you can do and be anything.
And you know, before 1980, that was true in America. We were one of the most socially mobile countries in the world. The economic class into which you were born was not the biggest predictor of the economic class in which you would die. And people could, you know, people could move up the ladder fairly easily. I think I'm a living testimony to that. Although, you know, everybody experienced that back in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s. And then, you know, Reaganism crept in and it kind of all fell apart. So now you work hard and play by the rules and you end up working three jobs and getting 2 hours of sleep a night and maybe you can pay your rent. We'll get back to Scott Walker in just a second. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon, you wanted to get back to my comment about the Iran hostages and how if we normalize relations with Tehran, with Iran, it may cause the news to come out that Reagan committed treason to become president.
Yeah, Tom. I was in the Air Force when all that stuff happened. And I was working in a calibration laboratory with a bunch of other fellows, and they were all right-wing crazy. But I managed to convince them that it was a done deal. When I saw what happened, I said, well, that was just a setup. It was obvious what happened. And eventually I managed to convince them all that I was right.
Yeah. Well, you were right, apparently. I mean, according to the president of Iran, you were right. And he was there. So, okay, Ed. Thanks a lot for that call, and thanks a lot for validating that. That's very interesting. Okay, back to Scott Walker. He wants to humiliate people who are down on their luck. After talking about how he came from humble beginnings, he's gonna talk about, and people who come from humble beginnings deserve to be humiliated because they don't have billionaires backing them, and they're not big shots. Here he is.
And now, as of the budget I just signed, we make the same requirement to make sure people can pass a drug test before they get a welfare check.
People can pass a drug test before they can get welfare benefits. Right. And everybody, oh, yeah, screw those poor people. Shame them. Yes, shame them. How dare they be out of work? Right. This is, you know, I'm telling you, this is the guy who's going to be the Republican nominee for president this year, next year. And he may well be our next president. I see in Scott Walker Richard Nixon's mentality and Ronald Reagan's policies. Richard Nixon, at least, was not a right-wing hack. Richard Nixon was, I mean, he was Eisenhower's vice president. He was to the right of Eisenhower, but he was Eisenhower's vice president. That was, he didn't try to overturn the New Deal. He didn't try to do away with unemployment benefits or do away with the minimum wage or cut Social Security or privatize it or do away with none of that stuff. Anyhow, now we get to the Republican meme that freedom means, sorry, buddy, you're on your own. You know, the old Alan Grayson, here's the Republican health care plan. Number one, don't get sick. Number two, if you do get sick, die quickly. Here's Scott Walker talking about that.
You see, that's freedom. The kind of freedom that's the cornerstone of the American dream. And so we've got a plan to help more people live that dream. A plan that will help more people create more jobs and higher wages. And you know what it starts with? We need to repeal Obamacare once and for all.
Right. To hell with those people who can't afford health insurance. Just let them die, right? They were stupid enough to get sick in the first place. And then this is pretty amazing. I want to riff on this a little bit more. This clip 22, Shane, play this, please.
We need to build the economy from the ground up in a way that's new and fresh, organic and dynamic, that says as long as you don't violate the health and safety of your neighbor, go out and start your own career, build your own business, live your own life.
See, now, as long as you don't violate the health and safety of your neighbor, what he's talking to is the core libertarian talking point that informed the Lochner Court in 1905, when the Supreme Court in the Lochner case, this was a case of bakers in New York. New York had a law that said that a baker can't work more than 10 hours a day, or if they do, you have to pay them overtime or something to that effect. And the court struck it down, saying it is not the business of government to protect workers. It is only the business of government to protect the health and safety of its people. So it's okay to have, a Department of Agriculture, you know, that inspects food, and it's okay to have an army and a police department, but it's not okay to get involved in private contract negotiations between workers and employees. This is the most fundamentalist of the libertarian ideas. And he makes it sound so appealing. Oh, yeah, if you don't violate the health and safety of your neighbors, if that's the criteria, then Scott Walker is saying, do away with Social Security, do away with Medicare, do away with Medicaid, do away with unemployment insurance, all those things the government does that have nothing to do with health and safety, that have to do with quality of life. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And we're only about a quarter of the way through these clips, but I'm going to be picking up your calls after the break, and you know, we'll get back to the clips a little later on in the show. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Roosevelt in Natchitoches, Louisiana. Am I saying that right, Roosevelt?
Hello.
Hey, you wanted to you wanted to set the record straight on my rant, and I think you're going to be spot on. Go for it. The point you wanted to make.
Yeah, the point I want to make. You said that Scott Walker. You said that people could get into middle class in the 50s. You know, but my father worked hard. He was a sharecropper, but he didn't even make half the money that the man that owned the place made. In other words, there was no middle class. I'm from a town called Negative, and we had what we call a oil mill. It made Amsterdam Little made of cottonseed oil.
Right.
And the black workers got half of what the white workers got.
Yep. And also, so the black soldiers who came back from World War II did not qualify for GI Bill, for many GI Bill benefits, and particularly the mortgage benefits that my dad got. So you're absolutely right. When I was saying anybody could make it in the 50s and 60s and 70s and even 80s, I was speaking about white people.
That's not true. Yeah, that's right. And then teachers, black teachers made half of what white teachers, and now that even transferred. When they retired, they wasn't getting as much as white people who retired at the same job.
Yep.
So that affects their children.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Roosevelt. And go ahead.
It's a continuation of the economic system. In other words, when my daddy came up, they didn't take Social Security from him until I think about 1956 or whatever. And then all that hard work he did, he didn't reap any of the benefits.
Right.
And therefore that came on me. Then that came on my children, you see.
Yep.
See, that, these white folks in Louisiana, they seem to not understand that.
You're right, and I'm one of those white folks who forgets that frequently. I mean, I grew up in white neighborhoods. I did business with white, most of my life, and it's very, very easy to get very myopic and only see your own life experience, and I was doing that. And so I've got to be more careful about that. I appreciate your reminding me, Roosevelt.
I think that's a problem with the Republican Party. It's a white party, and they don't see no further than white.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. You're absolutely right. And frankly, it's a problem, you know, in general with white people in this country who have, particularly those who have had very little contact with African Americans throughout their lives and don't work with them, don't know them, and which is probably the majority of white people in this country. And,
It's hard to get ahead in this country. You know, this is something, if you white, but if you black, I mean, you're on a different plane. You're on a different playing field totally.
Yep. And you start out in a different place. You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Roosevelt, thank you for the call, and thanks for keeping me honest. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. Flo in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Flo, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was thinking about I sent $75 to for the Scott Walker recall.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was a big waste of money, huh?
Well, you know, it caused the Koch brothers to have to kick in an extra $500,000, I'm guessing.
They could afford it, though. What I wanted to tell you, on the Business Channel, I heard the biggest Chinese takeover of a U.S. corporation.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese-backed government wants to buy the chip maker Micron.
Right. This
Technology
is
Technology Incorporated. So I don't think they should have to do that. I don't want them to.
Micron, for people who don't know what you're talking about, Micron is the last American chip maker in the world. It's the last American chip maker. They're based out of Boise, Idaho, that makes dynamic random access memories, DRAMs, and that makes NAND flash memories, which are used in mobile devices and things like that. DRAMs are used in computers. And the company that is that has made a bid for Micron, and they're offering a 19% premium over the price at which the shares are trading, so it'll be probably taken, is Tsinghua Unigroup Limited, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chinese government, the Communist Chinese government. It's a state-run business. And by the way, they already have a controlling stake in Hewlett-Packard's networking equipment unit, which they bought in May. So, you know, pretty soon, if this thing goes through, we won't be making anything in the United States that's necessary to make a computer. It'll all be in China. And if the Chinese decide to say to us, you know, we don't like the way you're behaving, we're not going to send you any more computers, we're going to be in deep doo-doo.
It doesn't have to go through. It goes through CFIUS first.
It goes through what?
CFIUS is a Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS.
Oh, yeah.
And
okay.
That's part of the Treasury Department.
Right.
And so I called and left a comment. They have a comment line on Smithfield, but they didn't listen to me there. Mm. But I left a comment, or you couldn't leave a comment. Their line was full. So I have to keep trying. They have a comment line.
Right.
But they have to approve it.
Right.
CFIUS does. And I don't know who's on the CFIUS committee, do you?
I don't. I frankly didn't know about it. So
yeah,
you're more well-informed on this flow than I am. I'm sorry.
Committee on Foreign Investment, and they have to approve. They approve the Xuanwei deal. Anything like that has to go through them.
And this is an agency of the executive branch? This is part of the Treasury Department or the Commerce Department?
I have a number for the Treasury. I wanted to leave something, you know, a message,
right.
Comment, but it was full. So
yeah.
I'm going to keep trying. But
okay.
Yeah, I don't think they should do this deal.
I don't think so either. But, you know, the reality is that we have an $11 trillion trade deficit, and that's basically, you know, a good chunk of that is trillions of dollars in the hands of the Chinese that they can only spend in the United States. So they come over here and they buy our companies. This is a $23 billion acquisition. Yeah. It's massive. It's absolutely massive.
So they have the money.
Yeah.
But I don't think we should cave to him.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you, Flo. Thank you very much for the call. Charles in Gallatin, Tennessee. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment on what you were talking about, Alan Grayson. I don't think the Republicans would want you to die too quickly. They would probably want you to live long enough where your life insurance policy would lapse and the insurance companies wouldn't have to pay you.
Right, and to live long enough that a for-profit hospital could, you know, run up a couple million-dollar bill on you, and et cetera. Yeah. Excellent point, Charles. Thank you very much for that. Terrell in Denver. Hey, Terrell, what's up?
Yeah, let's go, Tom.
What's on your mind?
I think our media is so bad that anybody could run for president. I think that Charles Manson could probably run for president. If he had $1 billion behind him, you know, they would totally sanitize the media of everything that he ever did. I mean, Scott Walker isn't doing good things in Wisconsin. Wisconsin isn't a closed society like North Korea, where they can't get people inside to find out exactly what he's done to that state. I mean, I think we should remove all political advertising and any type of money away from our media process.
Yeah, I agree. I think we should go to publicly funded elections, and we should require electronic media companies to provide free time for candidates.
Yes, and ethics and all that kind of stuff. I mean, if you're like, you know, SC Cup and you go to all this stuff, yeah, I want you in prison. Yeah, exactly. When you come on the air, and it almost looked like we're negotiating to bring our own country down.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, if these people were wearing turbans, they would be considered domestic terrorists, but they're wearing suits, so they're not. I mean, when are we going to really start talking about this? Because these things are not good.
Yeah. Well, this is the stuff that, you know, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are talking about a lot. And I think that it needs to be promoted more. And I'm going to continue talking about the damage that Scott Walker has done to Wisconsin and how lasting it will be. And the damage that he'll do to the United States, he will put Reagan's policies back into place on steroids. I mean, Obama has rolled them back a little bit, but you know, not consequentially. And Scott Walker is going to double down on Reaganomics and destroy this country in the process if he becomes president. Terrell, thank you for the call. Barbara in Culpeper, Virginia. Hey, Barbara, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I was calling to really compliment the gentleman who called the other day about putting the Cherokee chief, Norma Mankiller, on the $20 bill.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great idea. It's time for a woman bill, and I think it would be appropriate to put her on there.
Yeah. I think that we should look at several of our bills because they're all dead white guys. And it would be a good thing to have a Native American on one of our bills. It would be a good thing to have an African American on one of our bills. And frankly, given the substantial and growing role that Hispanic Americans are playing in American life, even though, you know, they by and large were not part of the quote founding of the country, I think it would be appropriate to have a Hispanic on one of our bills too. And you know, it's just, you know, it kind of goes back to history because of the you know, the white dominance of this country since its beginning, since its modern form beginning. History has been the story of the victors. It has not been the story of the vanquished. And so, you know, the story of what Native Americans went through in this great genocide, this great 300, 400-year-long genocide, is virtually never told, or it's only told in passing. And it's an ongoing thing. You know, Jeff Flake and John McCain just stole a bunch of land from the Apaches and from the San Carlos Apache tribe to give to an Australian mining company. It's outrageous. So, yeah, it's a Wilma Mankiller, right?
Right, Wilma Mankiller. Yeah, I think it would be great. And yeah. I think you're right. I mean, I think that all the, you know, all these white men, you know, where would we be without women?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I think Harriet Tubman should be on one of our bills. And you know, there's no shortage of great African-American men as well that could be on our bills. Barbara, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of Scott Walker and your calls. And by the way, we may pick up a little bit of the president after the top of the hour, too. Welcome back. Albert in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Albert, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Well, everything Scott Walker says makes me angry, but I was furious after that last clip you played of him. He said, as long as you don't threaten the health and safety of your neighbor, he works for the Koch brothers. Their fossil fuel industry is doing everything they can to destroy the health and safety of his neighbors.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent point. This should have been part of my rant. Excellent point, Albert.
Thanks for all the good work you do,
yeah.
Tom.
Well, thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. George in San Bernardino, California. Hey, George, thanks for watching Free Speech on DirecTV. What's up?
Yes, Tom.
Hi, George.
Good morning. Yes, I'd like to talk to you about the movement rules for the world.
George, I can't hear you. If you're on speakerphone, you need to take it off, and if not, you need to talk a little louder. Now we're on speaker.
You know,
George?
Made up these rules, like, you know, war crimes, who's a thief, who's a murderer. You know, well, murder is something that you can just, you know,
right,
put your hand on. But
who made up the rules?
Who made up all these rules? But I'm to the poor folks. Well, you know, I mean, the poor folks is the majority.
Right.
The majority are poor, more poor than rich folks in this world.
Correct.
So why is it the rich folks make all the rules that the poor people have to live by?
Because they can. I mean, I don't mean that to be funny. The rich people make the rules that the poor people have to live by because they can. They're able to afford to buy the political process. They're able to afford to own the political process. I was talking earlier about how ExxonMobil is continuing to fund climate deniers, particularly in Congress. And it's astonishing that, you know, as little as $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 will buy you an anti-climate change vote from a member of Congress. The Guardian has a great piece on this today. And, you know, so whoever's got the most money, it's the old, you know, it used to be a joke, but it's not funny, really. You know, it's the golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules. And that's what's been going on, George, in this country and in this world for a really, really long time. Thanks a lot for the call. Bob in Bullhead City, Arizona. Hey, Bob. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me?
I do. Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Great. You know, I just wanted to clarify the word murder and kill according to the Bible itself.
Okay.
George Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice are murderers. However, World War II and before, our country were killers of people that were doing absolutely wrong.
Now, yeah, and you could argue that the Hitler was a murderer and we were killers. Is that the point you're making?
And in the Old Testament, God speaks about it. In the Torah, it says, do not murder. It doesn't say do not kill. The Greek said murder was kill, but they're not the same thing.
That's interesting. That's interesting. Bob, thanks for that. Thanks for calling and sharing that with us. I appreciate it. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, nationwide, worldwide, whatever. I mentioned I have narrated a children's book. It's called Neighbors from Hell, an American bedtime story. And it's available as a, I guess, e-book over on Amazon. And say what? I have the book. Oh, yeah. Actually, there's a physical book, too. This is the... a physical book. It's published by Feral House. But the version that I narrated, the e-version, is also available. So it's all over at Amazon. And it was written by Jan Frell and a colleague of his. Jan is one of the editors over at Alternet, and among other things. And here's a little clip from it. Neighbors from Hell, an American bedtime story by Jan Frell and John Dolan. Illustrated by Taras Karacheko and published by Feral House. A bedtime story. It was bedtime again. Dan wanted a story. And no Dr. Seuss. I want it all gory. I'm talking real monsters let loose on our street. And I suddenly thought of the monsters he'll meet. Is he too young to know? He'll find out someday. He should hear it from Dad, not learn the hard way. So I said, listen, Dan, about half of our neighbors are monsters in some way. They come in all flavors. They don't have big fangs, big claws, or knives, but they're ruthless and mean, and they've ruined our lives. Tomorrow the repo men come, and we have to go. So before we're evicted, Dan, I think you should know just what kind of monsters are lurking right here, because they are the ones that you ought to fear. Yeah, and then he gets into basically all the neighbors, the banksters and, all these other folks. It's fascinating and funny, and it's a great little children's book, and I was glad that I could narrate it for them. Anyhow, back to your calls. Verbin in Macon, Georgia. Hey, Verbin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. On Scott Walker, I mean, he says he stands for the right to work, but, he does stand for it. He stands for the right to work you as a slave.
Right. It's the right to work for less is what I call it.
Yeah, and somebody had called in the other day asking about your second choice for Bernie's VP. I was wondering if I could get your take on that.
I still haven't come up with somebody better than Elizabeth Warren. I'm sorry.
All right.
I think that there are regional considerations and all those kind of things. He's got a real colleague in Sherrod Brown of Ohio, but again, you're pulling two people out of the U.S. Senate, two really good progressives. There are some good members of the House. I don't know. Yeah, the governor of Minnesota, what's his name? Mark Pryor? Oh, Dayton. Mark Dayton. Yeah. And, not Pryor, Dayton. And who's... a billionaire. He could bring a lot to it. But Verb and I, that's really for Bernie to decide and for the Democratic Party to decide. So we'll see where that goes. Thanks for the call, though. Steve in Phoenix. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Just wanted to talk about Walker here. I get an email from my buddy Dan back in Madison just about every day about all the damage he's done over the last three, 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just stupefying. but and it's confounding how he got reelected and beat the recall and all that.
Well, he got reelected with a pile of money from out of state.
Oh God, yeah. Well, from his handlers,
right? You know? His patrons, his owners,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, you know, he comes across. He's trying to come across as Joe Everyman. You know that he's a Joe Everyman, but you know. He really isn't, and here's another thing. You know, I don't want a Joe Everyman to be my president. I want somebody, you know, way smarter than I am to deal, you know, to deal with the myriad of complexities that a head of state will encounter. You know, we tried this, you know, experiment with the Dunsky Bush once already,
right.
And he almost ran our nation into the ground.
Right.
And I don't see how you can let this go happen again, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'd go beyond saying that W almost ran our country into the ground. He did run our country into the ground. Our national debt has doubled as a consequence of his policies. We were losing 800,000 jobs a month when he left office. We were stuck in the middle of two stupid wars, one of them clearly a criminal war, and we were the criminals. I don't want a Joe Everyman either. I'm very proud of the fact that my president right now, President Barack Obama, is a graduate of Harvard Law School and was a law professor, constitutional law professor, and is probably a lot smarter than I am. I mean, you know, I agree. I totally agree with you, Steve. Thank you for the call. Tony in Salem, Arkansas. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, I just want to talk to you about Scott Walker also. He's pushing a plan for Republicans, right?
Tony, can you speak up?
Yeah, their Republicans' plan to get more jobs in the country is to eliminate the union, eliminate all the benefits that the workers get, and when they're all working for nothing, let's bring all those jobs back from overseas.
Right.
You know?
I don't think they ever intend to bring those jobs back from overseas. I think they like the fact that the boisterous, troublesome, rebellious middle class of the 1960s and 70s and 80s has been replaced with a quiet and cowed group of working poor and indebted students who are terrified that they'll lose their financial their student loan, or that they'll get kicked out of college if they get arrested on a picket line or in a demonstration. I think they're very happy to have us turned into serfs. I think they're very happy Tony.
I think that's the goal. That's their goal exactly.
Yeah, and they're halfway there. And it's not like they've been hiding it. I mean, this was laid out by Russell Kirk in 1951 in his famous book, The Conservative Mind, which inspired Barry Goldwater and William F. Buckley and all these other people, and it created the modern day conservative movement. And Russell Kirk just lays it right out. He's in 1951, he basically predicted the 60s and 70s, saying young people would be demanding rights, minorities would be demanding rights, women would be demanding rights, and it would create social upheaval in the United States. And because the middle class had too much money. And, you know, too much money makes them fearless, and when they're fearless, they start demanding things. And the Republicans took that seriously. They continue to. Scott Walker is just the next one in line. Tony, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. We'll be back coming up on the top of the hour. I understand that the president, sometime in the next hour, it's supposed to be in about 5 minutes, is going to be speaking about the Iran deal. If he does, when we're on the air, we'll probably pick up a little bit of that audio. Beyond that, I'm going to come back with more Scott Walker clips.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We had a caller earlier from Phoenix. We've been on the air in Phoenix for a decade. And I just saw this thing. This is amazing. It's Off of Their Heads posted this over at Democratic Underground. When Bernie announced his town hall last Thursday in Phoenix, they booked a room at the Hyatt that held 2,500 people. By noon that same day, they had to change the venue to a room that held 5,000. I just now got a notice that they have had to change the venue again to the Phoenix Convention Center. There are still 4 days of signups to go. Feel the burn. Amazing. I'm telling you, I've been telling you this for about 2 years now, 3 years, I'd say, maybe even a little longer, since the rise of the Tea Party. How long has that been? Well, that's been 6 years. Tea Party rose when Obama became president, basically, as a backlash initially against a black president, I think, you know, for many of the people in the Tea Party, and of course, the Koch brothers against the policies of a Democratic president. And so for 6 years, what I've been saying is we are living in this populist moment. And in fact, I think that this is why Obama became president, because he campaigned as a populist. He campaigned on change. And the amount of change that we've gotten isn't what we all would have liked. But on the other hand, he's not had a Congress that's been willing to collaborate or work with him at all. And in fact, you know, there was a naked conspiracy in the caucus room restaurant here in Washington, D.C. the night of his inauguration back in 2009, January 20th, 2009, where these, you know, 15 members, senior members of the, both Senate and House Republicans got together and basically swore a blood oath to each other that they would block everything that he tried to do. And right now, Mitch McConnell is blocking his nominations of federal judges. They've got, you know, some, yeah, I don't know, teens to 20s, you know, some number in that range of federal judges stacked up. There's all these openings. I mean, John Roberts is complaining about it, that there's a lack of federal judges. The caseload is just, you know, off the chart. But the Republicans are refusing to, over the next year and a half, refusing to even consider these federal judges because they have to go through the Senate. They're refusing to even consider them in the hopes that Scott Walker or Jeb Bush will be the next president and a whole different slate of right-wing federal judges will be appointed. They don't want Obama to leave his mark on the courts the way that Reagan did. Reagan, who committed treason to get to win the election. Anyway, back to Scott Walker. You ready? Yeah, okay. This is clip number 7. He calls for a moratorium on all new regulations, and he wants to repeal regulations. Now, regulations, you know, they say regulations are job killers, but the reality is that most regulations actually increase the number of jobs, right? If you tell a power plant that they've got to put scrubbers on their chimneys, somebody's got to design those scrubbers. Somebody's got to manufacture those scrubbers. Somebody's got to install those scrubbers. Somebody has to clean those scrubbers. That's jobs, right? I mean, regulations actually, more often than not, increase jobs rather than decrease them. And they increase the quality of life in our country. We regulated the exhaust coming out of cars. So somebody had to design catalytic converters. Somebody had to manufacture them. Somebody has to service them, regularly. And by the way, our air got cleaner. But all of that seems to be lost on this guy who is the shill, the front man for the billionaire family, the Koch family, who, you know, inherited an oil empire from daddy and then added to that, other dirty industries like manufacturing paper through Georgia Pacific, you know, which if you've ever been near a paper mill and just take a breath, whew. So here is Scott Walker on saying, you know, we need to just let the billionaires poison us. It doesn't matter. Here he is.
As governor, I called for a moratorium on all new regulations. We can do the same in Washington, and then we can repeal all the other bad Obama regulations to get this economy going again.
Right. Repeal all those bad regulations. Like what? You mean like clean air, clean water? You know, that's amazing. And by the way, we're waiting for the president to show up. And here's a pander again, you know, as I said, Scott Walker's political career, in my opinion, exists in large part because of the largesse of the Koch brothers, who has inherited a fossil fuel empire from daddy. And here is Scott Walker pandering to big oil. Here it is, clip number 8.
Next, we need to put in place an all-the-above energy policy that says we're going to use the abundance of what God has given us here in America and on this continent. You know,
fracking, yes.
That's right.
Drill, baby, drill.
We are an energy-rich country, and we can literally start refueling our economic recovery. We need a president who on day one will approve the Keystone Pipeline.
Right, because the Koch brothers own millions of acres of tar sands land up in Canada, don't you know? Oh, man. And all of the above energy policy. Let's, you know, this is, Sarah Palin would have done it dumber, right? She would, you know, drill baby drill, right? Scott Walker, this guy is slick. I'm telling you, he is slick. He has, there's a very good chance he will be the next president of the United States. Having scoffed at Reagan back in 1979 and 1980 when he was, you know, running for the primary and against George Herbert Walker Bush principally, and then running for president. I thought, there's no way. Ronnie Reagan, everybody in America thought he was a joke. But he became president. Do not underestimate the power of organized money. Here's Scott Walker, the product of public schools. His parents went to public schools. He, you know, you'd think he would be all in favor of public schools, but no. Schools should be an opportunity for a billionaire to make a buck, don't you know? I mean, you know, we don't need no stinking public schools. Let's start a bunch of private schools, these charter schools and things, and the private schools can cherry pick the students that they want to take, so the students of by and large poverty and color end up in a ghettoized public school system. And this is not an accident, by the way. This is social engineering of the worst kind, along with crony capitalism, along with, you know, hey, let's just steal from the public trough. Here's Scott Walker on that.
I believe that every child deserves access to a great education, be it at a traditional public or a charter or a choice or a private or a virtual or a homeschool education.
Right. We don't need no stinking public schools. Whoever said we need stinking public schools? That's incredible. And then he wants to lower taxes on the job creators, right? Who is that? The rich people? I mean, here he is, clip number 10.
We need to lower the burden on our taxpayers so you can keep more of your hard-earned dollar.
Right.
We need to do that for individuals. We need to do that for individuals as well as job creators, because we need to make our job creators competitive again in the world so they can bring more jobs back from overseas to put more of our fellow Americans back to work right here in America.
Right. The way to bring those jobs back from overseas is not to change our trade policies. It's not to put tariffs on imported goods. It's not to have, you know, U.S. domestic content requirements. It's not to enforce the Buy America Act, which is still on the books, by the way, that says that the federal government has to source everything from U.S. suppliers. Unless there's a waiver, and Ronnie Reagan started issuing waivers like they were, you know, postage stamps. It's not to do that. Instead, it's to cut taxes on billionaires. If we cut taxes on billionaires, they will bring jobs back from overseas. Why? Because freedom, you know? Because cut taxes. Because job creators. This is scary stuff. I'm telling you, this is, you know, Ronald Reagan sold us on the idea of, from the back of a napkin that Art Laffer came up with the Laffer Curve, which Scott Walker referenced in this speech. We'll get to that as the day goes on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The clown car is not so funny anymore. The serious guys are starting to get serious. We'll be back. Welcome back. Johnny in Lamarck, Texas. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I liked your call, your discussion with Roosevelt, and I also liked Flo from Sunrise, Florida. We need more people like that who are not only informed but engaged.
Yeah.
Anyway, your conversation with Roosevelt reminded me of that daughter, granddaughter of the Confederate Revolution. I think that's what she was, and I've forgotten her name already. But she was on MSNBC the week or two following those murders in the AME church, and she was speaking glowingly about her nephew, I think it is, who's a state senator in South Carolina, who she said spoke eloquently or powerfully on taking down the Confederate flag. But what she also said, and I'm not too surprised, but just grossly disappointed and angry thinking about it, she also said that it was destined for him to be on stage to shine, and therefore those murders had to happen.
Yeesh.
Now, that's the kind of mentality that we're dealing with here, and this is not an isolated case. Time and again, we see these repos saying one thing and then revealing their true self over and over and over again. I have something I'd like to do.
What's that?
In front of you, in front of University of Houston, there's a boulevard called Calhoun Boulevard. It's probably named after the same John Calhoun. Why don't they rename that Hitaji Azee Boulevard? Hitaji Azee is a Houston activist, a black woman who has an interesting childhood growing up, and I hope she writes a book about this soon. She was also one of the on-air programmers here at KPFT. I would love for you to interview her at some time, talk to her, and maybe prompt her into writing a book about her life. They should rename Calhoun Boulevard in Houston after her.
Yeah. I'm
renaming high schools after Ronald Reagan, after the peace activists who worked for Greenpeace. Let's start educating the current youth instead of having them being brainwashed by these textbooks rewritten for history, for political correctness on the right.
Yeah, I'm totally with you, Johnny. Very well said. Thank you for that. Roland in Vail, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Roland, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I really want to appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. And thanks for all you do for the common people of our country. You know, you really keep us informed, including myself.
Thank you.
I'm calling regarding the McCain and Flake land exchange deal that took place here in Queen Creek, east of Phoenix.
Right.
I'm seeing a little bit of a delay in the television, so I'm going to kind of...
Yeah, turn off the TV. And we've only got about 45 seconds rolling, so let's get to it.
Okay. Ultimately, McCain and Flake were lobbied directly from these companies, Rio Tinto and another company from London. They bypassed the regulatory process altogether that most mining companies need to do. They did that, obviously, to go ahead and get the land without going through, again, the regulatory process.
So they took it by taking it right to Congress, they were able to bypass the executive branch? Is that the deal?
That's exactly what they did. That's exactly what they did. And
wow.
It got rolled over into the defense bill and got signed over. Obama had to sign it, so it was signed over. My concern is it's setting a precedent for other mining companies to come in and do exactly the same thing. And in the process, you know, again, take the land that we're part of and also the water that they're contaminating.
Right. Yeah, it's going to devastate that area, which is sacred to the Apaches. And John McCain and Jeff Flake just sold the Apaches down the river. And, you know, nothing that the Native Americans are not surprised by, but they're pretty horrified, and they're camping out there in protest. You might want to call McCain's office and Flake's office and let them know what you think. Thanks, Roland, for the call. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Remember I told you we were going to get to the Laffer curve? Well, here's the setup for it. This is clip number 11, and this is Scott Walker talking about Kohl's. Kohl's is a department store in a chain in the upper Midwest in Wisconsin, and that has, you know, does bargains and things. It's a little more locally owned, I believe. So here's Scott Walker talking about that.
So over the years, I've learned if I'm going to go buy a new shirt, I go to that rack that says it was $29.99, and now it's $19.99. And then we go up to the cash register, and we get out the insert from the Sunday newspaper, you know, the little scratch-off one there. Or maybe we get the flyer we got back at home, right, where you get 15 or 20, or if you're really lucky, 30% off, right? You know what I'm talking about. And then as the clerk is ringing it up, Toinette scoops into her purse and pulls out some of that Kohl's cash. And next thing you know, they're paying me to buy the shirt. Right? Well, not really, but it seems like it, right? So how does a great company like Kohl's make money? They make it off of volume, right? They make it off of volume. See, they could charge that higher price and a few of you could afford it, but they lower the price, broaden the base, and they make more money off of volume. That's what I think about your money, the taxpayers' money. You see, the government could charge you a higher rate, and some of us could afford it. But if you lower the rate, broaden the base, we expand the volume of people who can participate in the economy.
Right. Like, you know, with the flat tax. Let's lower the tax on rich people, raise the tax on poor people, flatten it out, have more poor people paying taxes. Now they've got skin in the game. This was the essence of Mitt Romney's 47% comment. And here with clip 12, he continues talking about the Laffer curve, this discredited crackpot economic theory that Ronald Reagan imposed on America.
Years ago, we used to call that a similar plan was successful under President Ronald Reagan. And back then, we used to call it the Laffer curve. Today, I call it the Coles curve.
Right. The Coles curve. Because, you know, like if you lower the price, that's the same thing as lowering taxes. And somehow, magically. And the Laffer curve has turned out, you know, so well for America. Really. I mean, trust me. Sam, in Hustisford, Wisconsin, you wanted to weigh in on Scott Walker? Sam? Sam is on line 9. Once again, I'm going to put him on hold. Danielle, you can check it out and see what's going on. So David in Pittsfield, Pennsylvania. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's good to hear from you. I've been watching you for years and just learned so much from you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I want to talk about every time I see guys like Scott Walker talk, it just makes my stomach turn, especially when they talk about health insurance. For almost a decade, I was denied health insurance because of so-called pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
When the Affordable Care Act came in, we were finally, both my wife and I, who are in our early 60s now, got health insurance. Well, this last month, it's paid off for both of us. Both of us in the last month have been in the ER because, well, I had the stomach flu and was dehydrated, and I need some medical attention. And my wife, well, she fell down a flight of stairs the other day and
Ouch.
Fractured her foot.
Ouch.
And it's just been wonderful that we were able to go in there, not worry about how we were going to pay the bill.
Right. Yep. Yep.
And when I hear these guys talk about they need to abolish the Affordable Care Act, you know, and they got this plan, but I never hear their plan.
Right. Well, it's because they don't have one, David. I mean, you know, the closest we got the last time the Republicans, you know, anybody seriously tried to pin down a Republican was health savings accounts. Let's just all, you know, put $5,000 a year into our savings account and tax free, and then we can spend it on health care, which is that's not a plan. That's a Band-Aid on cancer. So, David, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sharing your story. Gary in Satsuma, Alabama. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Yeah, Tom.
Yeah. Gary.
Let me ask you. Yeah. Hear me?
I hear you just fine.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question. The Supreme Court said that corporations are people, right?
Yeah. Well, they said that corporations are persons, not people. There's a difference, but yeah.
Okay, well, let me ask you a question. How come corporations can give multi-million dollars to campaigns and an individual like myself can only give $2,700 a year?
Good question. Because apparently corporations are super people, right?
Okay. Well, then
actually, a corporation can't. Actually, there's a federal law called the Tillman Act. Although, didn't that get struck down by Citizens United? Yeah. Okay.
Well,
corporations can't give money directly to campaigns. What corporations can do, Gary, is they can give money to super PACs, which is what they're doing.
Okay. Well,
the employees of the corporations can give money to campaigns, and that's when you look at OpenSecrets.org, for example, and look up any candidate, and that's what you'll see. Gary, I got a boogie here. We got the president? Yeah, shall we just, let's just carry 1 minute of him, see what he has to say.
Good afternoon, everybody. Yesterday was a historic day. The comprehensive long-term deal that we achieved with our allies and partners to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon represents a powerful display of American leadership and diplomacy. It shows what we can accomplish when we lead from a position of strength and a position of principle, when we unite the international community around a shared vision, and we resolve to solve problems peacefully. As I said yesterday, it's important for the American people and Congress to get a full opportunity to review this deal. That process is now underway. I've already reached out to leaders in Congress on both sides of the aisle. My national security team has begun offering extensive briefings. I expect the debate to be robust, and that's how it should be. This is an important issue. Our national security policies are stronger and more effective when they are subject to the scrutiny and transparency that democracy demands.
There you go. President Obama speaking right now, promoting his deal to Iran. It's funny because the Chiron on MSNBC said that he was going to defend it. Really? He's on the defense? I didn't know that. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I think he's kind of bragging about it. I mean, this is a really, really big accomplishment. And yesterday he thanked Vladimir Putin for his help. I mean, Russia was one of our negotiators. Welcome back, Tom. I'm here with you. The president is still speaking. Let's just check in and see what he has to say.
The possibility of Iran getting a nuclear weapon. And by the way, that was not simply my priority. If you look back at all the debates that have taken place over the last 5-6 years, this has been a Democratic priority. This has been a Republican priority. This has been Prime Minister Netanyahu's priority. It's been our Gulf allies' priority, is making sure Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. The deal negotiated by John Kerry, Wendy Sherman, Ernie Moniz, our allies, our partners, the P5 plus one, achieves that goal. It achieves our top priority, making sure that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. But we have always recognized that even if Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon, Iran still poses challenges to our interests and our values, both in the region and around the world. So when this deal gets implemented, we know that we will have dismantled the immediate concerns around Iran's nuclear program. We will have brought their stockpiles down to 98%. We will have significantly reduced the number of centrifuges that they operate. We will have installed an unprecedented inspections regime, and that will remain in place not just for 10 years, but for example, on the stockpiles, will continue to 15 years. Iran will have pledged to the international community that it will not develop a nuclear weapon and now will be subject to an additional protocol, a more vigorous inspection and monitoring regime that lasts in perpetuity. We will have disabled a facility like Iraq, the Iraq facility, from allowing Iran to develop plutonium that could be used for a bomb. We will have greatly reduced the stockpile of uranium that's enriched, and we will have put in place inspections along the entire supply chain so that if uranium was diverted into a covert program, we would catch it. So I can say with confidence, but more importantly, nuclear experts can say with confidence that Iran will not be in a position to develop a nuclear bomb. We will have met our number one priority. Now, we'll still have problems with Iran's sponsorship of terrorism, its funding of proxies like Hezbollah that threaten Israel and threaten the region, the destabilizing activities that they're engaging in, including in places like Yemen. And my hope is that building on this deal, we can continue to have conversations with Iran that incentivize them to behave differently in the region, to be less aggressive, less hostile, more cooperative, to operate the way we expect nations in the international community to behave. But we're not counting on it. So this deal is not contingent on Iran changing its behavior. It's not contingent on Iran suddenly operating like a liberal democracy. It solves one particular problem, which is making sure they don't have a bomb. And the point I've repeatedly made, and is, I believe, hard to dispute, is that it'll be a lot easier for us to check Iran's nefarious activities, to push back against the other areas where they operate contrary to our interests or our allies' interests, if they don't have a bomb. And so will they change their behavior? Will we seek to gain more cooperation from them in resolving issues like Syria or what's happening in Iraq to stop encouraging Houthis in Yemen? We'll continue to engage with them, although keep in mind that unlike the Cuba situation, we're not normalizing diplomatic relations here. So the contacts will continue to be limited. But will we try to encourage them to take a more constructive path? Of course. But we're not betting on it. And in fact, having resolved the nuclear issue, we will be in a stronger position to work with Israel, work with the Gulf countries, work with our other partners, work with the Europeans, to bring additional pressure to bear on Iran around those issues that remain of concern. But the argument that I've been already hearing, and this was foreshadowed even before the deal was announced, that because this deal does not solve all those other problems, that that's an argument for rejecting this deal, defies logic. It makes no sense. And it loses sight of what was our original number one priority, which is making sure that they don't have a bomb. Okay.
So the president is selling his deal with Iran, and a fine thing it is. He's not defending it. He's promoting it. Oh, man. By the way, you'll recall I started the show with a riff about how Reagan committed, or at least Reagan's campaign committed treason with Iran in order to become president. And, you know, we all know Richard Nixon did that back in 1968, committed treason with the government of South Vietnam, extending the war, blowing up LBJ's peace deal that would have gotten Hubert Humphrey elected president. What are they going to do now? What are the Republicans going to do if the press starts showing up in downtown Tehran and saying, you know, we'd like to see the records from 1980, you know, when the Israelis were actually delivering spare tires, they started out with tires, spare parts for the F-15s, I think it was, the American jets, fighter jets. This was even before the election. They were already paying off the Iranians for holding the hostages, or we were, via Israel. Or at least that's what Robert Perry and several others who have investigated this fairly thoroughly are suggesting. But the president of Iran, Bonnie Sutter, writing in the Christian Science Monitor. Anyhow, that story, I wrote that story up yesterday afternoon. I ranted about it this morning. It's up at the top of Alternet right now, if you're curious, alternet.org. So anyway, back to Scott Walker clips. Now we'll do that at the top of the next hour. Back to your calls. Let's pick up some phone calls here. Sam in Hustaford, Wisconsin. Hey, Sam, you want to talk about Scott Walker?
Hey, yep, Scott Walker, and just figure it's Watertown, Wisconsin.
Okay.
You know, as much as I'd like to get rid of Walker for Wisconsin, I really don't want him on the national level. Some of us are trying to slog through the 300-plus page budget that's just been passed.
Mm-hmm.
And we're finding more and more details of money that he's given away to private entities that he's taken away from our universities and you know, other public education sources, including, I believe, off the top of my head, he's committed $5 million to Marquette University and Carroll College, while he's taken $3.3 million away from the public health and medical school for public health. It's mind-boggling how bad he is and the things that he's done here. They're right now trying to commit $250 million for a Milwaukee Bucks arena and, you know, keeps pulling money out of public education, public health, out of our roads, I mean, everywhere. It's just, it's ridiculous what's happening. And the biggest thing that I think people really need to pay attention to is that between Walker and the Republican legislature, they have cut the staff for our Secretary of State, Douglas Follett, by two-thirds. He's down to one person, and they are trying to move him from a, I believe it's 4,000-square-foot office to a 900-square-foot office in the basement of the Capitol.
The Secretary of State? Why? Is he a Democrat?
Exactly. Doug's been Secretary of State in Wisconsin for a long time.
Huh.
And because of Act 10, when he published it on the 10th day, they were furious about that. They have been after him since then. And Doug has filed a lawsuit to hopefully stop this. But it's ridiculous, the amount of cronyism and just payback.
Oh, and yeah, and destruction of his political enemies. That's what I keep saying. You know, he's got Reagan's agenda, but he's got Nixon's mentality. It's the worst of both worlds. You know, yeah. he can pretend to be Ronald Reagan and be all nice and friendly and sunny, but behind the scenes, you cross him, he'll stick a knife in your back, metaphorically.
Yeah, like I said, as much as I'd like to get rid of him for Wisconsin, I really don't want to see him on a national level.
Right. You'd rather suffer in Wisconsin than have him inflicted on the entire country.
Exactly.
Sam, that's very big of you. That's very generous of you. I think that Wisconsin was a big experiment. I think the whole thing with the recall, everything else, this was the Koch brothers trying to figure out how much money does it take to basically buy an election. How much money does it take to change people's minds so that they literally think that up is down, white is black, you know, red is green, whatever. Amazing. Sam, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Still have another 15 or so the Scott Walker clips for you. Plus, we'll be taking your calls as we continue through the day here. Welcome back. Kathy, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Etna, Wyoming. Hey, Kathy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to give a plug on some of my husband's and my thoughts on potential VP or cabinet members if Bernie makes it.
Okay.
And big-time VP, we think, is Chris Hedges. He has foreign journalism experience and has had his hands, you know, dirty being in foreign countries. He's against the NDA. He's an opponent.
Right.
Anti-Wall Street.
He'd make a good Secretary of Defense.
Possibly, but I'm just trying to think big.
Yeah.
As far as VP goes. And then on cabinet members, great people, in our opinion, would be people like Richard Wolff, Bill McKibben,
yep.
Bobby Kennedy, Ralph Nader. And we love Naomi Klein and think of her highly, but I think she's Canadian, so
she
that
is.
Might not work.
Yeah, she is.
But we'd love to see him go outside of the box, you know, and really get some people with integrity, experience, but not necessarily politicians.
Yeah.
And that's a plug for us. And can I say one quick thing on Scott Walker?
Sure.
I was watching Bill Press a few months ago, and he was doing a segment on how Scott Walker did not finish college.
Right.
So he was adamant that there was no way he would vote a president of the United States as a, you know, that's a college dropout. So anyway, for whatever that's worth.
Yeah, being a college dropout myself, I can't criticize Scott Walker for that. Although I do agree with an earlier caller that I would like to have a president who's smarter than me. You know, Barack Obama, I think, is probably a lot smarter than me. And, I'm very pleased with that. And there's no doubt in my mind that George W. Bush is a lot dumber than me. And, you know, you can see what he did to this country. And a sad thing it was. So anyway, thanks a lot, Kathy, for the call. Thanks for the information. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, well, I can criticize him for being a dropout because I don't want somebody who's a quitter. My life doesn't matter if you drop out of college or not. You know, if you produce less of a radio show.
Yeah.
But it does to me, to the president. If you can't finish what you started, I don't want you in that job.
Okay.
Now, I want to talk you off the ledge about Scott Walker.
Okay.
He's not going to be elected, and I'll tell you one reason why. Keep letting him go on about the ACA. the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
That was just deemed by the Supreme Court as being legitimate, justified.
Corky,
so
millions
of people are going to sign up.
Right.
And it's going to be millions of votes against
it. Yeah, let me tell you how this is going to play out. Scott Walker, when he was running for re-election in Wisconsin, said, you know, I'm not so anti-abortion. We're not going to make that high on the priority list. As soon as he becomes governor, you want an abortion, you got to have a wand stuck up in you and get an ultrasound and you know, draconian stuff. He said, I'm not going to pick on poor people. As soon as he gets elected, you got to get drug tested if you want to have unemployment benefits. Scott Walker has flip-flopped over and over and over again right now, and he was fine with gay marriage before. Now he's opposed to gay marriage. He is playing to the hard right in order to win the Iowa and New Hampshire primaries, which I believe he will win. And once he does, he's going to do the exact same thing he did in Wisconsin, which is he's going to move back to the center, and he's going to be holding Jeb Bush's opinions. We'll be back. Corky, thank you. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old, goat.com, and free-don.org. Luke Vargas with the Talk Radio News Service is on the line with us, the UN Bureau Chief for TRNS. Hey, Luke, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So the Iran nuclear deal, how is this playing at the United Nations? Because that's the group that essentially negotiated it and that has to ratify it.
That's exactly right. The pickup in action at the United Nations has happened so much faster than even I thought it was going to occur. We knew sort of by design the point of, having the P5 lead the negotiations was to make sure that approval on the Security Council was all but guaranteed. But we just heard exactly 1 hour ago from New Zealand, which is chairing the Security Council for this month, that consultations are underway. The United States apparently introduced the resolution this morning at around 11 a.m. And setting in motion again what I don't think will be very long consultations on the actual text here. From what we were told, the negotiators already had the language of a Security Council resolution worked out at the time that the deal was announced yesterday morning. But again, the process of getting this formally endorsed by the Security Council is underway, and what we're hearing is that a vote is likely next week, that you'd probably have representatives from many of these countries, if not the presidents, their foreign ministers come to do this at the United Nations. So again, the timetable here really, really quite fast. I would predict UN Security Council approval for this deal by the end of next week.
So if this happens, that drops the international sanctions, and that just leaves the United States' sanctions in place, which can't be removed for 60 days until the president vetoes the efforts of the Republicans. Do I have that right?
Not quite. So, yes, I mean, by approving this deal likely next week, that would set this into international law. But it would only begin a 90-day countdown to what this deal calls adoption day. And it's at that point, you know, if we fast forward 90 days, 3 months, what are we looking at, October? It's then that IAEA inspectors will get their first crack at looking at Iran's compliance. Conceivably, let's say Iran in the next few months, during that 90 days, tries to, you know, tick off as many boxes, comply with as many of the nuclear-related agreements here. They could be found to be in compliance on that 90th day, and then the sanctions would drop. But it is only after that 90-day period that there's a possibility of the sanctions actually easing. And I would predict it'll be a little bit longer than that. We heard from Javad Zarif overnight that he thinks November is a likely time when they think the country can be found to be in compliance with the nuclear elements of the deal, and that those sanctions could conceivably begin to come down.
Right. Okay. Now, meanwhile, in Greece, the Greek government is, it is what, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, it's 8 p.m. in Greece right now.
Right.
Are they holding, is Parliament going into the night, or are they going to be voting on this tomorrow morning?
No, I mean, they have a deadline of midnight to be able to endorse this deal. I'm sure, you know, a slight delay would be tolerated, but I don't think that the expectation is they're going to push past it by very long. So the parliamentary debate on this seems to be accelerated, but so too has, I think, the complexities of the voting patterns here have also clarified a little bit today. We heard in the morning that the Syriza ruling party committee of about 100 people, around a half of them had expressed their disapproval of this deal. But many of those people are not lawmakers themselves. And when it came down to the actual Syriza MPs, the indications are that more of them are actually supportive of this deal, that they sense that there's really no going back, that they've got to do this. So the latest math I've seen indicates that Tsipras has been successful in cobbling together a coalition to pass this deal. But that doesn't mean things are going to go smoothly today. We're hearing more and more reports of mass protests, a lot of riot police gearing up, and the fear really is that, you know, you're going to have a vote in the middle of the night that is not going to be palatable at all to those many protesters, and that things could get a little bit hairy. But again, some demonstrations are the least of Greece's worries when you begin to look at the IMF assessment that was just published overnight about the long-term viability of this country. I think many people there realize what's in store for them, and even with a bailout, it's not going to be pretty.
Right, and the IMF basically said, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Luke, that this deal that Tsipras has agreed to, that you know, that was laid before them, doesn't contain enough reduction of Greek debt to be sustainable.
Yes, and among other things, they call for at least, this is, I mean, a number we never heard anything about before this, but 30 years of a grace period before Greece would begin repaying its debts on the European front. Among other things, the IMF pointed out that this expectation that Greece is going to be able to hold a 3.5% surplus of GDP for the coming decades is really without very much precedent globally.
It's a fantasy.
Let alone during austerity.
Yeah, it's a total fantasy.
It's a grim assessment. They also point out this the underlying, you know, assumption in the repayment structure here that Greece's workforce productivity is somehow going to go from being sort of in the bottom of the Eurozone area to somehow on the top. I mean, the market reforms in this deal make it seem pretty unlikely that either that or increased labor force participation are going to result from these terms. But again, yeah, that's the assumption this bailout has, and the IMF providing a really sober look and saying, you know, you really just can't expect that this is going
you
to
said,
come out. So.
You said here. Are you in Greece right now?
No, I was referring only to the deal. I wish I could be there right
yeah.
now. I'd very much like to.
Oh, I think it would be fascinating to be there right now. Meanwhile, the UN was supposed to have a ceasefire in Yemen, and it never stuck. What's the story on that? We've got about a minute.
This has, you know, been a big embarrassment for them. On last Thursday, they came out and announced that their Yemen envoy had received assurances from representatives of the Houthi rebels, as well as the government, I guess, in exile, if you want to call it that, of President Hadi, saying that he had talked to the Saudis, said that they were going to suspend their airstrikes, and none of this came about. That midnight Friday deadline came and went, and by all indications, fighting in Yemen has only intensified. We've heard today that Saudi-backed militias have retaken the city of Aden. So again, that's supposedly during a UN ceasefire period. I thought it was very telling that the State Department spokesman Kirby on Monday said, when asked, did the U.S. expend any diplomatic effort trying to convince the Saudi Arabian military coalition that's involved there to go along with this ceasefire? He said, no, we didn't expend those efforts. So again, a failing on so many people here.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We've been going through Scott Walker's announcement, his well-memorized, well-presented, I thought, actually, speech in which he introduced himself to America and said he's running for president. And, I stand by this. I may be wrong. Jeb Bush's family and his connections and the big money that he's got may make him the Republican nominee. But I believe that the Koch brothers' billions count for more than Jeb Bush's legacy. And that Republicans are underestimating the consequences to their party of the damage that George W. Bush did to this country and to the party. And putting another Bush on the ticket would be a disaster for the Republicans. And I think that increasingly they're figuring that out. And Donald Trump is certainly going after Jeb Bush like there's no tomorrow. But again, I think he's doing that to set up Scott Walker. So you'll recall in the last hour, I played you the clip where Scott Walker, it was about a minute and a half long, where Scott Walker goes through this thing about how he likes to shop at Kohl's, and he goes in, you know, which is a department store in Wisconsin. And he goes in and he buys, you know, he goes to the shirt that used to be $29.99 and now it's $19.99. And then his wife digs the coupons out of her purse. And he's, you know, hey, I'm just a regular guy, right? No, I'm sorry. He lives in the governor's mansion. You know, but in any case, he's just a regular guy. And then he says, I'm going to bring back Reaganomics with the Laffer curve. Remember the Laffer curve that said you need to cut taxes on the billionaires and that will stimulate economic growth? Here's the clip of that.
Years ago, we used to call that a similar plan was successful under President Ronald Reagan. And back then, we used to call it the Laffer curve. Today, I call it the Kohl's curve.
So what's the thing with Kohl's? Excuse me. I'm telling you, as Danielle came back and handed this to me and said, we have the smartest listeners and viewers on earth. Somebody called in and said, hey, check this out. This is from Bloomberg, Bloomberg.com. The headline, Scott Walker defends Wisconsin subsidies to Kohl's. Walker has been asked to respond to a Bloomberg story earlier this week that outlined how his administration awarded a state incentive package worth as much as $62.5 million to Kohl's in 2012 when there was a slight chance the company would move its national headquarters out of the state. Very interesting. So he gives $62 million to Kohl's, and then he praises them in his speech. Okay, clip number 13. If you had any doubts at all, that Scott Walker, with the temperament of Richard Nixon, try to bust his Secretary of State, who's a Democrat, out of a 4,000 square foot office. They've cut his budget to the point where he only has one staff person. Secretary of State is supposed to oversee all the corporations in the state, right? And the elections. And they've now they want to move this guy into a 900 square foot office, and he's got one employee. I mean, this is like, you know, this is how you punish your enemies. If you have any doubts that Scott Walker has the mentality of Richard Nixon, I mean, look at the one of the stories of why he left college was that he got busted. Basically, he was running for student body president or something like that, and the local paper endorsed his opponent, and his campaign staffers were caught stealing piles of newspapers out of newspaper bins and throwing them away so people wouldn't read the endorsement. So anyhow, if you have any doubt that this guy has the temperament of Richard Nixon but will follow the policies of Ronald Reagan, listen to this, clip number 13.
The Commander-in-Chief has a sacred duty to protect the American people. In my lifetime, the best president when it comes to national security and foreign policy was a governor from California.
Right. Well, first of all, he's saying governors are better for you than anybody else. And then, of course, he's pandering to Reagan. And, in fact, clip 14 here, he expands on that.
Under his leadership, we rebuilt the military. We stood up for our allies. We stood up to our enemies. And without apology, we stood for American values.
Yeah, when Al-Qaeda blew up all those Marines and killed, 230-some-odd Marines in Beirut, what did Ronald Reagan do? He turned tail and ran, pulled all of our troops out of Beirut. Now, frankly, I think that was probably the right thing to do, but that's not the way Scott Walker would talk. I mean, this is not the Republican. I mean, can you imagine if a Democratic president had done that? Not to mention, Reagan throwing $1 trillion at Star Wars, which still doesn't work. It was a crazy idea. It was an idea that Ronald Reagan got from a science fiction movie that he starred in. You know, toward the end of his presidency, he was mixing up his movies and reality and his Alzheimer's dementia so badly that he sat at a state dinner next to either the president of Israel or the prime minister or the ambassador. I forget which one it was, but it's fairly easy to track this down. You can Google it. It's in Will Bunch's book, Tear Down This Myth. sat next to this guy and told him how he had been there with the soldiers liberating Auschwitz, when in fact he never left Hollywood. It's just, I mean, you know, Reagan was, the best president we ever had. Iran-Contra? You know, negotiating with the Iranians to hold the hostages for an extra half a year so that Jimmy Carter would lose the election? At least according to the president of Iran? No slouch? Anyhow, speaking of Iran, clip number 15, here is Scott Walker.
Kevin knows that Iran is not a place to do business with. You see, Iran hasn't changed much since the day he and the other hostages were released on President Reagan's first day in office. Looking ahead, we need to terminate the bad deal with Iran on the very first day in office.
Right. Yeah, the first day that Reagan was in office, actually it was the minute. The minute that he raised his hand to take the oath of office, put his one hand on the Bible and raised his other hand, that was the minute that the plane left the ground in Tehran with our hostages, which was the Iranians' way of saying, done deal. Ronnie, you know, your campaign guy, Bill Casey, told us that if and there are some who say it was George Herbert Walker Bush. I'm skeptical of that. I think it was Bill Casey. But, you know, there's some evidence of either of them. The preponderance of the evidence seems to be Bill Casey, who was the campaign manager for Reagan, and Reagan paid him off for that by making him head of the CIA. And then when the Iran-Contra deal blew up, and it came out that Reagan was actually selling weapons in violation of U.S. law and international sanctions, was selling weapons to Iran, Bill Casey was subpoenaed to testify before Congress about, you know, where is this? Where did this start? Where did this come from? And the day that Bill Casey, the director of the CIA, the day that he was supposed to testify before Congress, and his lawyer, Milton Gould, had said he was going to tell the whole story, he was going to spill the beans, the day that happened, he had a seizure in the office of the director of Central Intelligence and was taken to Bethesda Memorial Hospital, to the Naval Hospital, and they cut open his brain and removed part of his left temporal lobe. That's Broca's region. That is the part that controls speech. He was unable to speak. It was like cutting out his tongue. He died a few weeks later from the surgery, from complications of the surgery. He was never able to testify, so we'll never know. But, you know, Scott Walker, yeah, Reagan was wonderful. Look at this. You know, first day in office, he got the hostages released. He negotiated it like 8 months earlier, maybe longer than that. It's amazing. It's amazing. We'll be back. As I said, you know, Richard Nixon's temperament, Ronald Reagan's policies. If you like that, Scott Walker's your man. And he's, you know, coming to a Republican Party near you. You just watch. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be picking up your calls. And I got a few more clips here. And we might drop in on the president. We'll see how he goes. 15 minutes after the hour, and Johnny O, watching Free Speech TV in Detroit, Michigan, the Motor City. Hey, Johnny O, how you doing? Johnny? Johnny is on line 8. I'm going to put him on hold, and you know, we'll see what happens with that. Bob in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Bob. What's up?
I'm going to announce how to win the election for Bernie, 100% for certain.
Okay.
I'm willing to bet up to $1.
Okay.
Maybe less. All Bernie has to do, not all, he's getting tens of thousands now. He needs to increase it to hundreds of thousands, like Obama did. The first announcement I'd like Bernie to make, which will kind of force Elizabeth Warren's hand, is to announce that he is appointing Elizabeth Warren as the chief of his transition team for all the hundreds, actually thousands of executive branch oversight committees and SECs, CFTCs, FTCs. It goes on forever.
Look. Why not make her as vice president?
Well, here's the thing. She, vice president, her independence would be lost. The biggest problem about Elizabeth Warren is being forced to follow anybody else.
Right, but then you'd have a woman on the ticket. I mean, you know, this is there are a lot of women in America right now who are very excited about the Hillary Clinton candidacy because no woman has been president or vice president.
However, but then they have to follow. If America knew that the smartest progressive person between her and Joseph Stiglitz in America that would handle our economy and oversee it, kind of as Bernie's partner, his non-marital partner. The important thing is that she would be the first person to have this much power that is not first a wife.
Well, he could give that kind of power to a vice president.
Well, as vice president, they all end up being forced not to be in conflict with Bernie. If she had a treasury...
Well, I don't think that there are any areas where she would be in conflict with Bernie. They are. I cannot think of a single issue on which they disagree.
Oh, well, you know, either way, I would love for him to announce at minimum he's going to offer her. I don't think you're supposed to. It's kind of a major office helping him, his economic overseer partner. And if she says, no, I'm not going to, but it would force her to stop running, trying to get Glass-Steagall pass, which is almost as bad as the Republicans trying to overthrow Obamacare for 50-some votes.
What's wrong with Glass-Steagall? Bob, it stabilized our banking system for 70 years.
Glass-Steagall is wonderful, except we know that this is not the time that realistically anybody is going to give it the attention,
right.
And anybody is going to pass it in the Republican Congress.
You're right about that, Bob, but it takes a year or two to really churn public opinion before you roll things like that out. So I think, you know, talking about it now is really important.
Yeah. Am I still there?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Okay. Glass-Steagall is a great thing to talk about. For the biggest reason politically to talk about Glass-Steagall coming back and getting rid of the Commodities Modernization Act,
right,
which allowed for more of...
Right.
More
Bob, we're out of time. I'm with you. I'm with you. Thank you for the call. Okay, President Obama's initial speech has now become essentially a press conference. He's taking questions from the reporters. Let's just drop in for a moment and see if it's anything interesting.
This incredibly gifted and blessed country. And with respect to the Medal of Freedom, there's no precedent for revoking a medal. We don't have that mechanism. And as you know, I tend to make it a policy not to comment on the specifics of cases where there might still be, if not criminal, then civil issues involved. I'll say this. If you give a woman, or a man for that matter, without his or her knowledge, a drug, and then have sex with that person without consent, that's rape.
So he's responding about Bill Cosby getting the Medal of Freedom.
I think this country, any civilized country, should have no tolerance for rape. All right. Have we exhausted Iran questions here? I think there's a helicopter that's coming, but I really am enjoying this Iran debate. Topics that may not have been touched upon, criticisms that you've heard that I did not answer.
Let's come back here, and we'll leave the president to his comment. You know, he's wrapping things up here. So, I've got a whole bunch more Scott Walker clips, and I know a bunch of you are on hold, and I will get to your calls. Let's see here. Clip number 15 We did that. Okay, clip number 16. Climate. You know, earlier I pointed out he shouted out to the fossil fuel industry a couple of times, basically to his patrons, the Koch brothers. Here's another one. Climate change? Yeah, climate change. Who cares? Clip 16.
Earlier this year, President Obama proclaimed that the greatest threat to future generations is global warming, climate change. Well, Mr. President, I respectfully disagree. The greatest threat to future generations is radical Islamic terrorism, and we need to do something about it.
Right, and we've had, what, in the last decade, you know, setting aside 9/11, of course. In fact, yeah, I think in the last decade or so, we've had 20-some-odd people killed by Muslim terrorists in the United States, and we've had over 50 killed by right-wing terrorists in the United States. And a lot of people are being killed by climate change on an ongoing basis. I mean, these mile-wide tornadoes, superstorms, giant typhoons, it's more to come. But of course, I mean, if you're the bat boy for the Koch brothers, if you're the one who carries their water, then you've got to say that climate change isn't real. Because they paid their money on fossil fuels. They're billions. They're tens of billions. Anyway, we'll get back to some more clips in a minute. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris, what's up? Chris, let's stay on serious. Okay, let's try Helen in Ithaca, New York. Helen, can you hear me? Let's stay on AM 1470. No? Geez. Are we having a Comcast problem again? Todd in Tacoma, Washington. Todd, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, you're on the air.
Okay, I heard on Amy Goodman's show today that Obama is going to a prison, the first president to do that.
Right.
And he's going to solitary confinement is one thing he's going to address, I hope. But another thing is the cannabis and how many prisoners we have because it's a Schedule I.
Right.
Or however they say
He also addressed yesterday or shortly, you know, recently he addressed prison rape and he suggested that we should stop making jokes about it in the media. And I think that's so right. I mean, I have seen so many cop shows where they basically imply, you know, okay, buddy, now we've got you. You're going to get raped in jail. And that, I mean, that's torture.
It is. Absolutely. And I was wondering if you've been watching the Orange is the New Black on Netflix, because if you could get Jenji Kohan and the person that it's Piper something, they were both, Piper wrote a book, she was in there, and this is a very interesting show. It shows the inside of women in prison. But I think if you could get Piper and Jenji Kohan, she also did created Weeds that was on Showtime.
Hmm. Yeah,
but those, you know, she would be. I mean, it's a very good show if you
have. Yeah, I haven't watched the new season, but Louise and I watched the first one or two seasons. Yeah, and I kind of lost interest toward the end of the second season because it basically turned into a soap opera. But Louise continued to like it. She's fond of soap operas, so you know, whatever. Anyhow, was that your point, Todd? Yeah, Obama's calling for changes to the prison system, right?
I mean, us having that many prisoners is just ridiculous how many prisoners we have.
Yeah, more than any other country in the world.
China. Yeah, and we need to do something about it, and it's mostly minorities.
Yep.
That's my main point, and I'm honored that our president is going to go into a prison and face these. Maybe he will go to a solitary confinement and see what's going on, because that is psychological damage.
Yeah.
To be.
And they've got people that they put in those solitary cells for decades.
That's absurd. Absurd. That's my main point.
Yeah.
Obama's visiting a prison. First president that I know of that's done that.
Yeah, good on him. Thank you, Todd, for the call. President Obama has, I think, in many ways surprised so many of us. Or not surprised, pleased. I was, you know, hoping for a good and consequential presidency. And I think he has provided us with one of the better presidencies of my life. It's a shame that the Republicans have done so much to thwart all the good efforts that he's made. There's so much more he could have done if he'd had a Democratic Congress, which is why it's so important that you make sure that you're registered to vote in the next election. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
I think this is going to be a huge election, and I think it's going to be a populist election. We'll see how this plays out. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And Pam in Falls Church, Virginia. Hey, Pam, what's on your mind today? Pam? Oh, no. Pam, if you can hear me, I can't hear you. Just call back, okay? Because apparently this problem that we've got with Comcast, it interrupts the phones in some way that you're still there, but you're not there, you know? But if you call right back, it'll get you on. Afagal, am I saying that right, in Huntsville, Alabama?
No, this is Afagai.
Afagai, okay.
Afagai,
welcome.
Yes. How do you do, Tom? Listen, listen with rapt attention about your dialogue about Scott Walker. He did say that he signed legislation that would seek or will drug test welfare recipients. You know, if he's that concerned about the doing good in his state, perhaps he ought to consider the random annualized test of anyone who owns a firearm for drug tests for them as well.
Hmm.
As a matter of fact, that should be a national program. If you own or possess a firearm, every year you have to submit to a drug test, random, so they can't prepare for it.
I view drug testing as intentional humiliation, Afagai. And, with regard to guns, my opinion is that we should do the same thing with guns that we do with cars. They should be, every gun has a serial number. It should be registered at the time of manufacture. Every time it changes ownership, that registration should change, the same as with an automobile, until it's ultimately destroyed. The owners of the guns should demonstrate that, just like you have to demonstrate you know how to drive a car and you get a driver's license, when you get a gun license, you should demonstrate that you know how to use a gun and you know how to safely store a gun and keep it away from your children. And number three, every gun owner should, just like every car owner has, have liability insurance. So if anything happens with that gun, you know, I think it's crazy that kid in Newtown, Connecticut killed all those children. And if they had been hit by a car, a drunk driver in a speeding car, or even a homicidal maniac in a speeding car, Geico would have been paying out, you know, liability claims to all their families. But because they were murdered with guns, they got nothing. The families didn't even get burial expenses because there's no insurance. So I would suggest that. I mean, to make it serious. I don't know if you're making a serious suggestion or if you're being, you know, kind of tongue in cheek on that.
I'm being quite serious. I also concur with what you're saying. I think that should be part and parcel of it. And the reason I am suggesting it is that there is that aspect of humiliation. If they want to inflict that on the least, the most vulnerable members of society, let's inflict it on the others.
Yeah.
So let them get a taste of their own medicine.
Yeah.
And speaking with something else, if I could just quickly,
sure,
about that liability. As you know, the Eric Garner family received $5.9 million from the city of New York.
Yes.
And that's great. But, you know, I think that every time a cop, any cop that gets sued civilly and there's a judgment that's made, you know, in this case, the plaintiff's favor,
mm-hmm,
I think every police officer should be made to pay 10% of whatever the actual damages are. So they have some skin in the game.
Yeah. You know, if police had to have the equivalent of malpractice insurance, I mean, a lot of doctors are very, I mean, they will just, you know, go out of their way to avoid being sued, you know, which makes perfect sense, even though it's their insurance company is going to get sued because their insurance rates are going to go up. And that's a marketplace solution you would think Republicans would love for police violence. If police departments had to have liability insurance or malpractice insurance for every single one of their officers, and the insurance company comes in and goes, you know, half the cops you've got here, you know, have no training. They don't know what they're doing. They're, you know, whatever. And this guy here, he's killed two people already, or he's twice been charged with, you know, recklessly beating people up. We're going to charge him three times as much for the insurance. That might clean up the police department somewhat. But you know, I understand what you're saying. I just think we should do away with drug testing, period. I think it's silly, and it doesn't. I really don't think it's making any of us safer. I mean, even drug testing of pilots and things. It's like, you know, if somebody's got a problem, you're not going to find it with a drug test. But I understand what you're saying, where you're coming from. I absolutely do. Thanks for the call. Albert in Los Angeles. Hey, Albert, what's up? Albert's not there. Albert, call us right back, okay? Scott in Deming, New Mexico. Hey, Scott, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. How are you, Tom?
Great. How are you?
Good. Hey, Tom, I'm a couple of years older than you, but I had an opportunity in 1968 to look down at a college class list and found Clyde Tombaugh teaching planetology. And being a fellow nerd to some extent, I took his class in 1 of 15 and got in it. And I just found out on the news, I didn't realize it, but his ashes were on board that probe that passed Pluto that we got pictures of the other day.
Whose ashes were on the probe?
Clyde Tombaugh.
Who?
The discoverer of Pluto. Clyde Tombaugh.
Oh, okay. The guy who discovered Pluto. They put some of his ashes on.
He's my old professor. I had him in college.
Oh, wow. Is that cool?
Class. And yeah, he was professor emeritus at New Mexico State.
Wow.
On the Mars Project.
Wow.
And he was still teaching an occasional class, and I was lucky enough to get in. Wonderful man.
Yeah.
And I was going to make this comment to you real quick, was simply that it would have been cool if we'd spent an extra $100,000 to shoot a probe and land his ashes on the planet.
Mm.
So
yeah.
Kind of cool.
Yeah.
He's headed out.
There you go.
One minor comment. I thought I'd just lighten it up today, but I personally have been more afraid in my whole life of the nukes that the United States has than I ever have of Iran having one or any other country.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think that nuclear weapons in the Middle East, frankly, you know, the area is so small. It would be like, you know, Connecticut firing nuclear missiles at Massachusetts. They, you know, they might as well just shoot themselves. But yeah, I don't disagree. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Albert in Los Angeles. You want to try it again, Albert?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I do.
All right. I'd like to talk about Iran as well, you know, and how they kind of get this terrorist, you know, label placed on them. The 9/11 Commission report said that most of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia.
Right.
Arabs. Iranians are Persians. I've never seen a time when there's been an Iranian attack America. Not one.
Yeah.
I think they get labeled this terrorist, you know, label because they support the Palestinians where, you know, to be honest, most of the world supports the Palestinians if we break it down. And I think this holdup is totally done by Israel. And I would like to ask you this question because you're way more knowledgeable than I am. What is the strategic importance of Israel?
It's a good question. I don't know the answer to it. I'm sorry. I think it's a good thing to have a democracy in the Middle East, and Israel's a democracy. That said, though, and I've always been a very, very strong supporter of Israel and their right to exist and everything else. But the last couple of years, the way that they've been treating people in Gaza, I'm just horrified. I'm just horrified.
And I think that's how the world has changed. I think everybody was on their side. But, I mean, when you look at the core issue, there should easily be a two-state solution, and half of the world's problems go away.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And Netanyahu will not do it, which is tragic for Israel and for the world, in my opinion, as a supporter of Israel. I think it's tragic for Israel. Albert, thank you for the call. Pam in Falls Church, Virginia. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Oh, I just want to mention that last Thursday, on July 9th, I was able to see Bernie Sanders at a public policy forum in Arlington, Virginia that was outstanding. It was full house, about 500 people. It was not a campaign event, but it was rebuilding the American dream.
Uh-huh.
And some of the sponsors left groups for the Progressive Caucus. But at any rate, I've followed him for some years, especially on your show. And elsewhere, and a lot of other national figures on televised or live, a few. And I just couldn't get over the presence and how commanding he is in person in a room. His main speech was 45 minutes, and then they did a Q&A. with Dawn Beyer and other representatives. So it was just an amazing event of 2 hours with Senator Sanders. And also I wanted to mention that in addition to a lot of his platform issues that he brought up, he did stress, which I particularly liked, how we must vote. We have to mobilize to get out the vote this time. And that he will go to red states, not just blue states, as you know,
right,
to try to
He was just in Alabama or Mississippi.
Yes. And last year he did some veterans speaking events, I believe, in the Carolinas and elsewhere. So that's a good thing. And also was it yesterday he tried to call Happy Bastille Day. We can't forget that.
Oh, yeah. The French Revolution started today.
Yeah.
That was yesterday, actually, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was July 14th, 1789, and my dream is Thomas Piketty to be used in some way for the next administration.
Oh, wouldn't he make a great Secretary of the Treasury?
Yes, he would. I mean, we gave Lafayette honorary citizenship, so maybe we can do a visa if he's willing for Mr. Piketty. And I don't know if you've ever interviewed him or possibly I missed it.
We tried, but we were not able to get him on. He's
well, he was so hot for a while there,
He's quite the international rock star.
Yes, he was. And by the way, there's another speaker that I was able to see. I saw Hillary once in 06 in my house party event. She spoke about her future concerns. It's very good. But there's one that I saw on a book talk over at Politics and Prose last year, who was so outstanding. His name is Modesty Hartman.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You know what we should do tomorrow, Shano, is we should alternate Scott Walker clips and Bernie Sanders clips. We cut up Bernie's Madison speech. We got about 20 of each. And welcome back. Nicole in Chandler, Arizona, watching us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Nicole, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. I have a couple of things, actually, I'd like to address. I wish that we were in town to see Bernie when he was here in Phoenix. He definitely has my support.
Well, he's going to be in Phoenix in 4 days.
Oh, good. I'll go and see him again then.
Yeah.
Or I'll make an attempt, I should say.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Scott Walker. I had a conversation with my brother this morning, and I said, I hope Scott Walker is the Republican nominee because he has done so much to the destruction of his own state that this country would be crazy to even vote for him, and Bernie or Hillary or I love Gavin Newsom if he threw his hat in, would win by a landslide. And my brother reminded me, he said, don't be so naive. America voted Bush in twice. And I thought, okay, maybe you're right.
Well, I'm not sure we voted Bush in twice. You know, in 2000, when the New York Times and that consortium of newspapers a year later in 2001, it came out in November of 2001, when they finally counted all the ballots, they found that by any measure, Al Gore got more votes than George W. Bush did. So that was really that election was stolen by the Supreme Court. And Al Gore actually won it. Now, oddly enough, the New York Times in the article that talked about that had a very misleading headline. It said, a recount shows that George Bush would have won Florida based on Gore's strategy, or words to that effect. And basically what they were saying was that if Gore had continued with his lawsuit in just three counties, which is where he had started, then he still would have lost, which is true. But if they had recounted the entire state, as the New York Times did, then by any measure, including the overvotes, Gore easily won the election. So, and then the re-election 4 years later, I mean, it was in the middle of a war. War presidents are almost always re-elected, as George W. Bush knew, as he told his biographer Mickey Herskowitz in 1999. If he became president, he was going to be a war president. So, I think we got snookered.
Sorry, getting back to the original election, isn't there something criminal that Catherine Harris did that should be punishable by jail time?
Yeah, she threw 80,000 African Americans off the voting rolls in Florida 3 weeks before the election, and thus putting George at the behest of George W. Bush's brother Jeb, and specific request of Jeb, and thus putting George within spitting distance of stealing the election.
Has anybody or anybody
The NAACP has had a lawsuit going on against Florida. I'm quite sure that that lawsuit is still active. And, you know, I don't know the status of it. We should contact the Florida NAACP and see what's going on with that. But there, you know, there has been some, you know, a lawsuit. But yeah, Catherine Harris was rewarded with a seat in the House of Representatives for one term. And she turned out to be so ditzy that the Republicans wouldn't support her anymore. And so they kind of pulled the plug on her. But
she's a criminal.
Yeah, she was not punished. She was elevated, which is astonishing. But yeah. Okay, Nicole, thank you very much for the call. Great to hear from you. We will be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. And thank you, by the way, Nicole, for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Bill in Kent, Ohio. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to bring attention to preservation of the commons, that Obama got the three sites, one in California, one in Nevada, one in Texas, national monuments.
Yeah.
I used to live in California and camp right around Snow Mountain from Lake County. Used to see it. It's a such a beautiful, beautiful icon. And
this while
everybody should hear that.
Yeah, this while the Koch brothers are funding a group that one of their frontmen wrote an op-ed in the New York Times saying, you know, it's time for us to privatize. Well, actually, he didn't say this. He said this in other venues. Time for us to privatize all our national parks.
Right, yeah. And, you know,
because the billionaires can run them so much better.
Today,
yeah.
Apropos of, you know, your conversation on Scott Walker, something he would never do.
Right.
Never do.
Yeah, yeah. And modern-day Republicans forget that Teddy Roosevelt, who created our national park system, was a Republican. He was also a progressive, though, so and there's no longer any progressive Republicans. Bill, thank you for the call. Excellent point. Lee in Jonesboro, Tennessee. Hey, Lee, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thank you so much for taking my call. Back in 2012, when Karl Rove had his meltdown on Fox News because the election didn't go his way, I seem to recall either hearing or reading somewhere, don't recall where, that Anonymous had taken responsibility, saying that Rove's minions were trying to electronically steal the election, not just in Ohio, but also in Virginia and Florida, but that they were able to put up a firewall to prevent that from happening, and that Rove's people tried somewhere in the neighborhood of like 170, 180 some odd times to break through the firewall before they finally gave up, and that this sort of thing didn't just happen in 2004 in Ohio, but also happened as early as 2002 in Georgia in both the governor's race and the Senate race there.
Right. The polls were showing the Democrats ahead by 2 points, and the final vote count was that the Democrats lost by 2 points. The results were flipped, right? Upside down. Yep.
Right. I just want to know if there was there any documentation that Anonymous really did put up a firewall?
I don't know. Your memory and mine are the same. Of the time and of the stories, but whether Anonymous ever said here's the proof that we did this, I'm guessing not. I would think that if they had, that there would have been, you know, at least in the press on the left, there would have been a fairly exhaustive analysis of it, and I've never seen that.
Right, and is there any way to prevent this from ever happening again, especially in 2016?
That's a damn good question. I mean, you know, you ask Bernie that question, and he says, why don't we just go back to paper ballots? You know, like the rest of the world votes, most of the rest of the world.
Why don't we? I mean, you buy a pack of gum in the convenience store, you get a receipt.
Yeah.
You vote electronically, there is no receipt.
Correct. And this is how Don Siegelman lost his governorship in Alabama, too.
And hopefully he'll be pardoned, but I'm beginning to wonder if that's ever going to happen.
Yeah, well, go over to free-don.org and you know, plug in your help in any way you can. Lee, thanks for the call. I'm sorry I don't have a quick answer for you. Maybe somebody else will. Ed in Riverside, California. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I thought you were smarter than me, but you let something go by today.
What's that?
When you played the speech about Walker talking about Kohl's.
Right.
He said, you full price for people that can pay, then you get a discount, and then you get your coupons and your dollars.
Right.
That's not Reaganomics. That's taxing the rich.
That's progressive taxation. But then he said we need to flatten everything. He basically used the Kohl's story, and then he basically said, but, you know, we've got to do this discount store thing, you know, that Kohl's does. But, yeah, you caught it. You're right. If you were to take his metaphor and extend it, it would be a progressive taxation metaphor. Absolutely. Thank you, Ed. Nate in Bay City, Texas. Hey, Nate.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good. You don't think Israel's a democracy?
No, I don't. I'm a big fan of yours, and I'm a big fan of Bernie Sanders. I just wanted to point that out. I'm definitely voting for him this time. And I don't believe that Israel is a democracy because it's an ethnic state. It's a state defined by an ethnic definition of Judaism that, you know, really is determined by ancestry and genetics.
Well, but within that context, it's a democracy. But yeah, your point is well taken.
For ethnically defined Jews, according to the state of Israel, it is a democracy. But for the people who live within its borders, it's usually not.
Yeah.
You know, the if you take all of the Palestinians who either live within the purview of the Israeli government or who have an internationally defined right to live in that area under international humanitarian law, the Jewish population is a small minority.
Right, which is
millions of refugees.
Right, which is a real
allowed return.
Right, which is a real existential problem, a crisis, frankly, I think, for Israel, and one that they're going to have to reconcile. And I don't have any easy solutions for it. Nate, thanks for the call. Ray in Hawthorne, California. You got 1 minute, Ray, till the end of the show.
Okay, I just wanted to say that they keep saying that people on Medicare are lazy. Well, I'm on Medicare, and I've been on Medicare since 1996. I'm bipolar, and at one time I was put in a mental hospital, and I couldn't get a gun for 5 years, which would be over in November. So that doesn't make you crazy. I'm not going to go out and kill people. I know people who are bipolar also, they aren't going to go, you know, kill anybody either. So saying that this one guy in the theater was insane at the time, none of us are going to go out and kill people.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, frankly, anybody who kills people the way James Holmes did is insane, but I don't think that they necessarily meet the definition of insanity that would cause us to put them in a hospital rather than a prison. I think James Holmes should end up in prison. Ray, thanks for the call. And good luck with your life. Sounds like you're doing well. Thanks so much for being with us today. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport, although Scott Walker would like you to think it is. And so it's time to get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.